Harper Audio presents Going Rogue, An American Life, written and read by Sarah Palin. Copyright 2009 by Sarah Palin. Production and abridgment copyright 2009 by HarperCollins Publishers. It was the Alaska State Fair, August 2008, with the gray Talkeetna Mountains in the distance and the first light covering of snow about to descend on Pioneer Peak. I breathed in an autumn bouquet that combined everything small-town America with rugged splashes of the last frontier. Cotton candy and foot-long hot dogs, halibut tacos and reindeer sausage, banjo music playing at the Blue Bonnet stage, baleen etchings, grass-woven Eskimo baskets, and record-breaking giant vegetables grown under the midnight sun. Inching through rivers of people with trig, our four-month-old son cradled in my arms, I zigzagged from booth to booth, from driftwood art to honeybee keeping to home-brewed salmonberry wine. Bristol and Willow, our teenage daughters, roamed ahead with friends, heads together, laughing, thumbs tapping cell phones. Piper, 7, my constant sidekick since the moment she was born, bounced along at my hip, pinching off fluffs of cotton candy, her reward for patiently accommodating my stop-and-go progress through the crowd. For the most part, she was comfortable watching the grip-and-grin photos and hearing the friendly chit-chat with constituents that I enjoyed as part of my job as governor of the state. Every few moments, I pulled my right arm free from baby duty to shake hands with folks who wanted to say hello. Hey, Sarah, you never miss the fair. Oh, my goodness, is that the new little one? Let me say hi to him. Price of energy's pretty high, Governor. When are they going to ramp up drilling? A robin's egg sky arched overhead, the brisk kick in the air hinting at winter's approach. Like a family conga line, we wound our way among the vendors and exhibits, from pork chops on a stick to kettle corn, veggie weigh-ins, and livestock competitions. A local dance troupe took to the stage and the music blared, competing with the constant hum of generators and squealing kids on rides. Ahead, on my right, I saw the Alaska Right to Life booth, where a poster caught my eye, taking my breath away. It featured the sweetest baby girl swathed in pink, pretend angel wings fastened to her soft shoulders. "That's you, baby," I whispered to Piper, as I have every year since she smiled for the picture as an infant. She popped another cloud of cotton candy into her mouth and looked nonchalant. Still the pro-life poster child at the state fair. Ho-hum. Well, I still thought it was a nice shot, as I did every time I saw it on its advertisements and fundraiser tickets. It reminded me of the preciousness of life. It also reminded me of how impatient I am with politics. A staunch advocate of every child's right to be born, I was pro-life enough for the grassroots Alaska Right to Life folks to adopt Piper as their poster child, but I wasn't politically connected enough for the state GOP machine to allow the organization to endorse me in early campaigns. From inside the booth, a very nice volunteer caught my glance, so I tucked my head inside, shook hands, and thanked the gracious ladies who put up with the jeers of those who always protested the display. With their passion and sincerity, the ladies typified the difference between principles and politics. As I signed the visitor's book, I saw Piper's picture again on the counter and became annoyed at my own annoyance. I still hadn't learned to accept the fact that political machines twist and distort public service and that a lot of times, very little they do makes any sense. Years before, I had seen our state speeding toward an economic train wreck. Since construction began in 1975 on what would become Alaska's economic lifeline, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, it had grown increasingly obvious to everyday Alaskans that many of their public servants were not necessarily serving the public. Instead, they had climbed into bed with big oil. Meanwhile, in a young state whose people clung to America's original pioneering and independent spirit, government was growing as fast as fireweed in July. It didn't make sense. It seemed that true public service, crafting policies that were good for the people, had become increasingly derailed by politics and its infernal machines. but I had a drive to help, an interest in government and current events since I was a little kid, and I had become aware of the impact of common sense public policy during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. I was intrigued by political science in college and studied journalism because of my passion for the power of words, and I had been raised to believe that in America, anyone can make a difference. So I got involved. I served first on the Wasilla City Council, then 2 terms as mayor, helping turn our sleepy little town into the fastest-growing community in the state. Then I served as an oil and gas regulator, overseeing the energy industry and encouraging responsible resource development, Alaska's main economic lifeline. In 2002, as my second mayoral term wound down, my husband Todd and I began to consider my next step. With 4 busy kids, I would certainly have enough going on to keep me occupied, even if I chose to put public service aside. And for a while, I did. But I still felt a restlessness, an insistent tugging on my heart that told me there were additional areas where I could contribute. From what I could see from my position in the center of the state, the capital of Juneau seemed stocked mainly with good old boys who lunched with oil company executives and cut fat cat deals behind closed doors. Like most Alaskans, I could see that the votes of many lawmakers lined up conveniently with what was best for big oil, sometimes to the detriment of their own constituents. When oil began flowing from Prudhoe Bay in 1977, billions of dollars flowed into state coffers with it. The state raked in more revenue than anyone could have imagined. Billions of dollars almost overnight. And the politicians spent it. Government grew rapidly. 1/4 of our workforce was employed by state and local governments, and even more was tied to the state budget through contracts and subsidies. Everyone knew there was a certain amount of back-scratching going on. But an economic crash in the 1980s collapsed the oil boom. Businesses closed and unemployment soared. During the oil boom, anyone who questioned the government's giving more power to the oil companies was condemned. What are you trying to do? Slay the golden goose? But when the boom went bust, the golden goose still ruled the roost. By then, state government was essentially surrendering its ability to act in the best interests of the people. So I ran for governor. I didn't necessarily get into government to become an ethics crusader, but it seemed that every level of government I encountered was paralyzed by the same politics-as-usual system. I wasn't wired to play that game. And because I fought political corruption regardless of party, GOP leaders distanced themselves from me and eventually my administration, which really was fine with me. Though I was a registered Republican, I'd always been without a political home, and now, even as governor, I was still outside the favored GOP circle. I considered that a mutually beneficial relationship. Politically, I didn't know anyone, and nobody owed me. That gave me the freedom and latitude to find the best people to serve Alaskans, regardless of party, and I was beholden only to those who hired me, the people of Alaska. Still in the Alaska Right to Life booth, Piper said she was ready to go. She was antsy to stop by the fair's hula hoop contest. So I hurriedly shook a couple more hands and gathered Trig back from the nice lady who had asked to hold him. I had certainly gotten off on the wrong foot with the Republican Party by daring to take on the GOP chairman, Randy Redrick, and then incumbent governor, Frank Murkowski. Party bosses weren't going to let me forget that I had broken their 11th commandment. Thou shalt not speak ill of a fellow Republican. Even if Murkowski did have a 19% approval rating, his chief of staff would later plead guilty to a felony charge, and it appeared corruption was growing at a breakneck pace. I didn't have time to waste embracing the status quo, and never had it in me to play the party's game. That just meant I'd have to work harder, advancing the state not on the currency of traded favors, but on the strength of ideas that prove themselves good for the people. This was the only way I'd found to transform a grudging bureaucracy into a team that could try to reform government and shrink its reach into our lives. Since being elected governor in 2006, I had managed to rack up an 88% approval rating, and though I didn't put much stock in fickle polls, I figured my administration must be doing something right. To me, it signaled that Alaskans, with their independent spirit, wanted principle-centered policies, not the same old politics as usual. I was grateful. All I wanted was a chance to work as hard as I could, serve the people honorably, and I figured that maybe between changing state government and changing diapers, we'd help change our corner of the world. In the Right to Life booth, I smiled, dropped some dollars into the contribution can, and didn't care who might be watching, including local reporters. Alaskans knew my pro-life views, no news there. At that moment, one of my BlackBerries vibrated me back to work. I was thankful for the excuse to hustle back into the sunshine. Piper tugged on my arm with sticky fingers, whispering reminders that I'd promised if she was patient, I'd take her on a roller coaster ride too. Just this one last call, baby, I told her. I ducked behind the booth, hoping it was my son, Track, calling from his Army base at Fort Wainwright. He was set to deploy to Iraq soon, and his sporadic calls were something I lived for. But in case it wasn't Track, I offered up a silent fallback prayer. Please, Lord, just for an hour, anything but politics. I punched the green phone icon and answered, hopefully, "This is Sarah." It was Senator John McCain asking if I wanted to help him change history. From Sandpoint, Idaho, where I was born, via Juneau, Alaska, I touched down in the windy, remote frontier town of Skagway, cradled in my mother's arms. I was just 3 months old, and barely 60 days had passed since the largest earthquake on record in North American history struck Alaska on Good Friday, March 27, 1964. The quake altered the topography of Alaska forever. Mother Nature showed her might and reminded us that she always wins. But that didn't scare my parents, Chuck and Sally Heath, who weren't about to change their minds about pulling up stakes in Idaho, where my dad was a school teacher, and settling in America's untamed north. Instead, my parents thought the Good Friday earthquake, with a 9.2 magnitude, the second largest ever recorded, added to the aura of rugged adventure that lured them to the 49th state, which was then only 5 years old. My big brother, Chuck Jr., was two at the time, and my sister Heather was one, so they were old enough to sit up by themselves in the Grumman Goose we flew in on, a 1930s-era plane that looked like it came straight out of the movie Casablanca. By the time the Heath family arrived, the population of Skagway was only about 650, way down from its heyday in the summer of 1897, when the town boomed with thousands of fortune hunters who streamed in with the Klondike Gold Rush. Skagway was a sweet start in life. Mom and Dad rented a tiny wooden house built in 1898 on the corner of First and Main. Alaska's wealthiest banking family, the Rasmussens, owned it. 30 months after we landed in town, my younger sister Molly was born. We added a couple of dogs and a cat, and the Heath family was complete. Perched on the rim of a harbor at the northern apex of the Inside Passage, Skagway is encircled by mountains. I remember the air smelled of ocean salt, and that even though the town was small, it bustled with boats in port, locomotives churning through to Canada, and the hum of propellers on the gravel airstrip right near the middle of town. I remember lush emerald moss hugging the hillsides. Mom always said she was going to buy a carpet that color someday, and one day she did. The southeast Alaska winters are brutal. In Skagway, icy winds tear relentlessly through town. But I don't remember the winters as well. I mostly remember sunny summer days. Playing dress-up with my sisters under a wild crabapple tree. I remember community basketball games. And I remember arguing with the nun who taught catechism and tried to teach me to write the letter E. It seemed a naked letter to me, so I was determined to reinvent it. I insisted she let me improve it with at least a few more horizontal lines. I shared a little bedroom with my sisters while my brother, Chuck, slept in a closet, which also doubled as a sewing room. Chuck was all boy. Once he pulled the town fire alarm. The fire chief visited our home, and Dad's hand visited Chuck's backside. Another time, he pulled a burning catalog Dad used as kindling out of our rock fireplace, dropped it on the living room floor in a panic, and nearly burned Mr. Rasmussen's house down. My sisters and I loved our big brother, and we loved each other, but still, we all scrapped like Wolverines. Mom had agreed to give Alaska a one-year trial run, but our short stint in the quaint old tourist town, inaccessible by roads, turned into 5 years of Dad teaching and coaching, working summers on the Alaska Railroad, and tending bar in seasonal tourist traps. Mom stayed busy herding 4 small kids and driving a seasonal tour bus, and was active in community theater and the Catholic Church. Both of our folks loaded us up for activities like hunting, fishing, and hiking, carting us on sleds or in backpacks when we were too young to walk. The spirit of Alaska is unique, combining awe for the untamed majesty of nature, a rugged individualism, and strong traditions of mutual aid. People still come to Alaska seeking adventure and a chance to test their mettle in the wilderness. Good people, like my parents Chuck and Sally Heath. He arrived for the hunting and fishing, but actually hit the trifecta. He got the adventure he yearned for and earned his master's degree in education and got a pay raise to boot. The state of Alaska was paying a premium, $6,000 a year, more than twice what he was paid in Idaho, to attract more teachers. So Chuck and Sally Heath packed up their 3 babies, all under the age of 28 months, and headed north to Alaska on the adventure that became their life. In those days, it was unusual for an entire family to pull up stakes and relocate to the last frontier, unless you were a member of a multi-generational Alaska Native family, like my husband Todd's. It was usually the family breadwinner who trekked north to seek adventure and job opportunities, while the nuclear family remained in the safe, known confines of the lower 48. 5 years later, Mom and Dad piled our 6-person clan into a blue 1964 Rambler, barged it on a ferry to the Alcan Highway, and drove us through part of Canada into Anchorage and a new chapter of Heath family life. We moved into a duplex 15 miles outside Anchorage so Dad could teach at Chugiak Elementary School, in a town that was really just a little smudge on the map outside the state's biggest city. Mom worked part-time as a school lunch lady at Eagle River Elementary School, and I love the fringe benefit of her bringing home leftover homemade rolls from the cafeteria. She later became our school secretary. My first clear memory of school was when my kindergarten teacher willed a black and white television into the classroom so we could watch American astronauts land on the moon. The lunar landing had happened in July 1969, before school started, but even watching taped images of an American walking on the moon stirred in me an overwhelming pride in our country that we could achieve something so magnificent. A similar feeling stirred in me as my class recited the Pledge of Allegiance. I felt proud and tall as we pledged on our hearts every morning. Early on, I gained great appreciation for the words we spoke, the United States of America, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. I knew those words held power. It wasn't common in Alaska to have many fresh fruits and vegetables from the lower 48. Transportation costs drove food prices through the roof. So a lot of what Alaskans ate, we raised or hunted. Moose, caribou, ptarmigan, and ducks. Dad and his friends became their own small game taxidermists. Even today, my parents' living room looks like a natural history museum. And when an earthquake hits, Dad can tell the magnitude by how fast the tail wags on the stuffed cougar that crouches on a shelf over their big picture window. When we were kids, we raised chickens, caught fish, and dug for clams. In summer, we picked wild blueberries and cranberries and raspberries. We grew produce like carrots, lettuce, and broccoli, but never could compete with the world record-setting cabbages like you see at the Alaska State Fair. The 2009 cabbage winner was a valley farmer who grew a 127-pounder. That's twice as big as Piper. We usually baked our own bread and drank powdered milk that was sold in big red and white carnation boxes. In so many ways, Alaska is a playground. When lower 48 parents tell their kids, go play outside, there may be limited options in suburban backyards, but Alaska kids grow up fishing the state's 3 million lakes in the summer and racing across them in winter on snow machines, kicking up rooster tails of snow. We hike, ski, sled, snowshoe, hunt, camp, fish, and fly. We have the highest per capita number of pilots in the world. In Alaska, we joke that we have two seasons, construction and winter. As I grow older, it seems construction season, summer, never lasts long enough. Even in a good year, summer speeds past in a three-month flash from mid-May to mid-August. In contrast to our long winter darkness, the blessed summer light creates a euphoria that runs through our veins hour after hour. There's still more time and more daylight to accomplish one more thing. If we told our kids to be home before dark, we wouldn't see them for weeks. The never-ending sun so elongates the days that by September, newcomers to the state, or chichacos, say they're exhausted enough to hibernate until spring. In the early 70s, after 2 years outside Anchorage, my parents saved enough to buy a little house about an hour up the road in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley, or Matsu, in the one-horse town of Wasilla. Not far from home, near the Talkeetna Mountains, I learned to hunt. Traveling on skis and snowshoes, we harvested ptarmigan and big game. I love meat. I eat pork chops and thick bacon burgers and the seared fatty edges of a medium well-done steak. But I especially love moose and caribou. I always remind people from outside our state that there's plenty of room for all Alaska's animals, right next to the mashed potatoes. In our northern state, with some communities located hundreds of miles from big grocery stores, Alaskans have for generations lived on local organic protein sources. Anti-hunting groups are clueless about this. It always puzzled me how some of the people who think killing and eating animals in the wild is somehow cruel have no problem buying dead animals at the grocery store wrapped in cellophane instead of fur. By the mid-1970s, Alaska's economic advantages had begun capturing as much attention as its natural beauty. Construction of the 800-mile-long Trans-Alaska Pipeline was underway. High-paying pipeline jobs brought thousands of new workers to the state. It was a new gold rush that sent truckloads of cash into the state's economy. Jobs were plentiful, and Dad had many opportunities to leave teaching and start making real money on the oil pipeline, along with thousands of others who would capitalize on this huge piece of infrastructure. But he loved teaching, and he loved his students, so he chose making a difference in kids' lives over making money. The employment boom and energy production were the upside of development. The downside was the concurrent spike in social problems. Without the law enforcement resources to keep things in check, prostitution, gambling, and illegal drugs proliferated in the growing population, especially in pipeline towns like Fairbanks. The boom also stressed local infrastructure, including schools and healthcare facilities. Meanwhile, some Alaska Native leaders knew they must aggressively protect the natural resources to which they were spiritually and physically connected. Thankfully, the young state's founding fathers and mothers ensured that the state constitution contained specific language guaranteeing equal rights and protections to all Alaskans, and empowered the First Peoples' participation in the state's economic and political life. One of those participants was Todd's mom, Blanche Kallstrom, who was among those who helped work on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The legislation would ultimately secure land and money to establish Native corporations and ensure their inclusion in future resource developments that came from their Aboriginal lands. It was during these early years that Mom became interested in an expanded faith. She sought further spiritual fulfillment in addition to the liturgical traditions of the Catholic Church. In Wasilla, she volunteered as a secretary at the Presbyterian Church on weekends and traveled to northern Alaska Eskimo villages on mission trips. At about that time, her best friend, Mary Ellen Moe, a newly transplanted Texan, invited her to attend an evangelical church in Anchorage. There, Mom found a depth of spirituality she had been seeking, the filling of what French writer Blaise Pascal called the God-shaped vacuum in every human heart. Back in Wasilla, the most alive congregation was our local Assembly of God, so my siblings and I attended Sunday school there and enjoyed attending the youth group with our friends. There weren't many churches in our small town, and though my family would eventually worship at a non-denominational Bible church, a lot of kids joined the youth group because it did a great job with activities that were what people used to call good, clean fun. One summer, I attended a youth Bible camp in Big Lake and understood for myself what Pascal was talking about, looking around at the incredible creation that is Alaska, the majestic peaks and midnight sun, the wild waters and teeming wildlife. I could practically see and hear and feel God's Spirit reflected in everything in nature. I reasoned that if God knew what He was doing in this magnificent creation, how much more did He know about me? If He is powerful and wise enough to make all this, and thought also to create a speck like me, there surely must be a plan, and He'd know more than I did about my future and my purpose. I made the conscious decision that summer to put my life in my Creator's hands and trust Him as I sought my life's path. My siblings and I were baptized together in Big Lake's freezing, pristine waters by Pastor Paul Riley. I got into the habit of reading Scripture before I got out of bed every morning and making sure it was the last thing I did at night. Ever the pragmatist, I also tested God's promises. For example, God says in Scripture, "Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. Test me in this, says the Lord Almighty, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that you will not have room enough for it." As a kid, to me that meant if I earned $5, I put 50 cents in the offering plate. Later, my husband Todd and I saw that there were many ways to share our blessings with others, like buying a tank of gas for a bush pilot so he could fly supplies to a remote village. Not only was doing those things personally rewarding, but God continually proved His promises true, blessing our giving with giving of His own. In the Heath home, very little time was spent watching the boob tube, as my folks called it. Even in the 70s, television shows were still tape delayed in Alaska by as much as a week, and a lot of news was old news by the time it filtered up north. It was sometimes easy to fall out of the news loop. But still, in 1974, when I was 10, I noticed that the newspapers kept running front-page stories on what they were calling Watergate. News broadcasts kept repeating the same theme. President Richard Nixon was in trouble. I was fascinated with the civics lessons that unfolded across America that summer. It amazed me that the whole country seemed riveted, unified by watching the events unfold. It was the first time since the moon landing that I'd seen that. So I knew this Watergate thing had to be big. When Gerald Ford took over, I knew who he was because I remembered reading about him and seeing a picture in a Scholastic magazine. He'd been America's vice president then, sitting parade style atop the back seat of a convertible, waving at the crowd. And now he was our president. Looking back, it seems significant that many of my clearest childhood memories involve politics and current events. I don't remember my 10-year-old friends being especially interested in who the president was, but to me, it was a pretty big deal. The 1970s ushered in the running craze across America, and my family was hooked. Mom and Dad had their friends training for marathons even on sub-zero winter days, and in the summertime, we ran together in the sunlit nights. On weekends, we squeezed in 10K family fun runs. My parents and sister Heather became decent marathoners. Dad qualified for the Boston Marathon and proudly represented Alaska twice at the big show. Mom, who was not at all athletic growing up, won her age group in the 26.2-mile Mayor's Midnight Sun Marathon, a testament to how Alaska can change a person. At the time, running with my family was just a fun and expected thing to do, but it became a lifelong passion for me. For one thing, you don't have to be particularly coordinated or talented to do it. Eventually, though, I realized that the road, and especially marathon training, holds invaluable life lessons. That to reach your goal, you have to put in the tough, drudging miles. That the best rewards often lie on the other side of pain. And that when it seems you can't take another step forward, there is a hidden reservoir of strength you can draw on to endure and finish well. Some would call it something spiritual. Others would call it personal resolve. But I believe that reservoir resides in all of us. We have opportunities to tap it. A couple of decades and four kids later, I finally reached my goal of running a sub-4-hour marathon by a few seconds. When I finished that hellish exercise, I considered it one of my greatest accomplishments because it just hurt so bad. Every year in school, I ran for something in student government. Vice president, treasurer, something. One year, I served as one of the student representatives for the Matsu School Board. Our rival school, Palmer High, sent a representative who was the undisputed queen of the Matsu Valley, a dazzling and brainy cheerleader, Kristen Cole, who would play an important role in my future. We were all expected to participate in most everything offered in our hometown. Of course we'd be in 4-H and Campfire Girls and Scouts and ballet and band. Of course we'd take foreign language courses and join the National Honor Society. And we went from sport to sport to sport. One part of athletics I really appreciated was our local chapter of Fellowship of Christian Athletes, which I co-captained under the leadership of the Wasilla Warriors wrestling coach, Mr. Foreman. At least 60 of us met in public school classrooms for Bible study and inspirational exchanges that motivated us to focus on hard work and excellence. In those days, ACLU activists had not yet convinced young people that they were supposed to feel offended by other people's free exercise of religion. As an athlete who advanced more on tenacity than talent, I wanted sports to be my future, but was realistic enough to know I wouldn't always be a player. That's why, with my passion for both sports and the written word, becoming a sports reporter seemed like a natural fit. There were a few women in the field, but I couldn't see any reason why more women shouldn't bust through and succeed in this arena. Leslie Visser had already shattered the ceiling, breaking into the profession when the rules of the press box were plainly printed on media credentials. No women or children allowed. I set out to follow that path, even memorializing in my high school yearbook my goal of someday working in the broadcast booth with Howard Cosell. Granted, conventional wisdom at the time was that sports reporting was a man's world, but in my family, gender was never allowed to be an issue. My parents gave us equal opportunity and expectations. We were all expected to work, build, chop, hunt, fish, and fight equally. I'm a product of Title IX and am proud that it was Alaska's own Senator Ted Stevens who helped usher through the federal legislation in 1972 to ensure girls would have the right to the same education and athletic opportunities as boys. I was a direct beneficiary of the equal rights efforts that had begun gaining traction only the decade before. Later, my own daughters would benefit, participating in sports like hockey, wrestling, and football, which had been closed to girls for decades. I didn't subscribe to all the radical mantras of the early feminist era, but reasoned arguments for equal opportunity definitely resonated with me. It was a matter not of ideology, but of simple fairness. Standing on the shoulders of women who had won hard-fought battles for things like equal pay and equal access, I grew up knowing I could be anything I wanted to be. Years later, I came across a book by fellow Alaskan and former basketball rival from Fairbanks, Jessica Gavora, called Tilting the Playing Field, about the liberating effect of Title IX on women's sports, and I agreed with a lot of what she wrote. Instead of reflecting and, indeed, reveling in our expanded horizons, the feminism of the National Organization for Women and other so-called women's groups depicts women as passive victims rather than the makers of their own destinies and overlooks our individuality in favor of a collective political identity that many of us find restrictive. In high school, I played basketball, my name next to number 22 on the varsity roster all 4 years. I mainly rode the bench during close games until my senior year because I played point guard behind a much stronger player, my sister Heather. We were the Cinderella team my sophomore and junior years, having fallen short in hard-fought state championship games in back-to-back years. But as soon as Heather and her senior teammates graduated, the B team finally had the opportunity to prove we had it in us. By my senior year of high school, I had been praying that God wouldn't have in mind for my future one of the local boys I'd grown up with. I love those guys a lot, but I looked at them all like brothers. I had just about given up hope that I would ever meet a guy I could really like as more than just a buddy. Then a new kid came to town. In late August 1981, my dad drove to Wasilla High to get his classroom ready for the start of the school year. That night at dinner, he had news to share. "Stopped by the gym to talk with some of the coaches today," he said. "That new kid, Palin, was there. I watched him practice for a while, and I can tell you right now, he's the best basketball player Wasilla's ever had. My ears perked up. A week later, between our pickup basketball scrimmages in the Warrior Gym, I finally met this mystery guy. When I saw him, my world turned upside down. I actually whispered, "Thank you, God." Todd Palin roared into my life in a 1972 Ford Mustang. Handsome and independent, he was part Yupik Eskimo and had moved to Wasilla from Dillingham, a fishing town on the chilly, rugged shores of Bristol Bay. Todd was only 16 and had come to town to play his senior year of basketball on a strong Warrior squad, a goal that coincided with career opportunities for his parents. His newly remarried father, Jim Palin, was in line to run the local electric utility. His stepmom, Faye Palin, would move up to vice president at the telephone company. Todd was so different from any kid I'd ever known. He made all his own decisions, from finances to future plans. Not only was he one of the only kids in town who owned his own ride, he owned two, the Mustang and a 1973 Ford F-150 long bed pickup that he used to haul a pair of Polaris snow machines. By the time I met him, he had honed an independent spirit and a sterling work ethic that drew me like a magnet and would help define me and clarify my life's priorities more than anything else. Todd thought nothing of doing things like driving the 50 miles into Anchorage by himself anytime he wanted to, which was a big deal to the rest of us, who had neither vehicles nor parents who would let us do such a thing. Todd had purchased his rigs himself, which blew us away because not many Valley kids had such luxuries, much less own them outright. He didn't come from a wealthy family, but from a very hard-working family. He was a commercial fisherman, drifting for red salmon in the rich waters of Bristol Bay. It was his native family's tradition to make their livelihood and subsist on the water. Todd made more money as a young teen in one fishing season than I'd made with all the jobs I'd ever had, combined over many years. Todd's grandmother, Lena, who was almost 90, is a Yupik Eskimo elder and was one of the first female commercial fishermen on the bay. His grandfather, Al Andre, was a boat builder. Together, Al and Lena helped start the Bristol Bay fishery in the 1930s, drifting for salmon from sailboats, navigating the frigid winds and ebb and flow of the tides, figuring out, even on windless days, how to get fish to the tenders where they sold for just a nickel apiece. The women braved the icy chop, the fish slime, the blood, and the stench out there fishing with the men, and Lena was one of the first. Todd started fishing Bristol Bay at a very young age and grew up in this multi-generational industry. Lena saw the fishery as a God-given resource that provided for the family. She believed in sweat equity. Using commercial fishing as an economic bootstrap, Todd's family owned and operated the town's hardware store and hotel, mechanic shop, and other businesses, ultimately employing scores of people. Their efforts in free enterprise became an economic engine in the region. The Palin-Kallstrom family was also the most generous I have ever met, willing to give the shirts off their backs for those in need. Todd's mother, Blanche Kallstrom, ran her businesses that way and has been materially blessed for being so generous to others. Todd has always had great respect for Alaska's environment. Through meeting him and his family, I began to truly appreciate not only Alaska's natural diversity, but its social diversity, too. Todd came from a different world than I, with this huge, exotic family that splintered off in several directions and was impacted by some of the societal ills that plague Native villages in Alaska. Though his upbringing was unconventional and tough at times, Todd bore down and built a reputation for working harder than men twice his age. Men who had far more tools and advantages than this kid who shuffled among parents and grandparents and great-grandparents' homes. Todd had what is uniquely beautiful in our native culture. Cousins everywhere. It's tradition that even a second or third cousin is referred to as cousin, and his family seemed to have hundreds. Todd witnessed things that many Americans never will. There are tough conditions in some villages, and the harsh circumstances lead some to abuse both alcohol and each other, and societal ills that include despondency and suicides. Todd saw it all. He also saw opportunities to react to circumstances in productive ways. Despite his still core, Todd was shy and quiet in demeanor, typical of Yupik men who, unlike some others, don't feel the need to fill up the air around them with words all the time. He was also incredibly well-mannered and polite to my parents, who were smitten with his work ethic and his constant offers to help anyone who needed anything. He stacked firewood for Dad and drove my mom out to the mountains so she could find the perfect skiing conditions. He picked up Molly and me for practices so we wouldn't have to walk. Todd and Dad hit it off because not only could Todd fix anything, but Dad had never met anyone who had an even greater respect for Alaska and her wildlife than we did. My family fell in love with Todd right along with me. Coming from a family full of very strong, independent women, Todd didn't find me a surprise in that way, but he tells me that he was most attracted to my solid family. He was crazy about my parents and knew that if they were such good family people, we had the potential to continue that tradition. As we grew up and grew together, our priorities became apparent. Neither of us was into heavy-duty materialism. We weren't into fancy food, fancy clothes, fancy anything. He was very practical. He bought his car because he needed transportation. He bought his truck to haul his snow machines. We certainly had differences. I was broke. I was nerdy. I played the flute. He cussed. He chewed. He didn't go to church. But when he told me he had become a Christian and had been baptized at a sports camp a few years earlier, that was the clincher for me. My friends and I lived for basketball, and at the beginning of my senior year, we counted down the days until the season began. A reporter from the Mat-Su Valley Frontiersman asked for my preseason prediction. Speaking for the team, I declared that we'd go all the way, that we wanted a state championship. To us, losing state for a third straight year would be intolerable. I spoke off the cuff and from the heart, but walked away from the interview with a sense of dread, fearing that my words would be interpreted as cocky and naive. When the sports page came out, I swallowed hard, read what I'd said, and decided I'd have to work that much harder to live up to my bold proclamation. It was supposed to be a rebuilding year for the Warriors. But my friend Karen Bush and I, and other bench warmers like Jackie Kahn and Michelle Carney, Amy, Wanda, Katie, and Heidi, resented the years we had spent riding the pine. We were determined to make up for it, to show our respected Coach Teagarden and Coach Randall what they'd been missing out on, and to seize the opportunity to win. As a captain, I played furiously. I drew a lot of fouls, but I brought everything I had to every practice and every game. I left everything on the court because I simply wanted the team to win. I was certain I wanted victory for my team more than any opponent wanted it, and that would be the key to reaching my goal of a state championship, even though we were an underdog team. When I have opportunities to speak to athletes today, I always ask these kids what I asked myself that season. Who wants it more? Who will work harder for it? And who will be the most prepared when the opportunity arises to score and win? I was bold, but pragmatic. I reminded my teammates that through all our years playing the sport together, all our camps, our practices, games, seasons, our obsession with it all, at one time or another, we had defeated every one of our opponents, so there was no reason we couldn't beat them one more time in that final shining season. Game by game, week by week, our scrappy but determined team surprised everyone by piling up victories. As the season progressed, I recalled my newspaper prediction and thought that maybe we had a shot at making it come true. We were on a roll. But then I stumbled, and it was hard, painful, and very public. During a game in the regional tournament a week before state, I came down wrong on my right foot, twisted my ankle underneath me, and felt a sickening pop. Coach Teagarden carried me off the floor, and the rest of the team carried us to regional victory. I was devastated to think that my season, my dream, was over. It was just days before the state tournament, and I refused to see a doctor because I didn't want to hear him say something was broken. I hobbled around and sat on the bench through a week of practices with my foot planted in a bucket of ice. But after all we'd been through, I decided it would be over my dead body that I'd sit the bench in the state tournament. At state, we battled through the bracket and made it to the championship game. our little Wasilla Warriors team faced the big Anchorage squad, the Service Cougars. Coach T knew how badly I wanted to play. I had shown him through four seasons that I would give 100% effort, no matter the cost. So he took a chance, and he gave me a shot. He put me in the game. I made it up and down the court, not gracefully, but playing as hard as I could. I'd never worked so hard for anything in my life, because I'd never wanted anything so badly. I felt like I couldn't pull my weight, but I encouraged the team. If we stayed together and played selflessly, I promised them we would win. My teammates were tenacious, intense, and focused, and we never let up. I scored only 1 point that game, a free throw in the waning seconds, but we pulled off the upset. That victory changed my life. More than anything else to that point, it proved what my parents had been trying to instill in me all along, that hard work and passion matter most of all. Everything I needed to know, I learned on the basketball court, and to this day, my right ankle is a knobby and misshapen thing, a daily reminder of pushing through pain. In May 1982, Todd and I walked together during our graduation ceremony in the Warrior Gym, dressed in caps and gowns to match our school colors, red and white. Over the next 6 years, we kept walking together, though we'd be thousands of miles apart. Todd headed off to play basketball at a college in Seattle, but eventually felt drawn back to Alaska, to the kind of hard work he thrived on. He earned his private pilot's license in Prescott, Arizona, along the way. I kicked off college by taking a semester to thaw out. Along with my best friend Tilly and two other girlfriends, we flew to Hawaii for our freshman year of college. Our intention was to play basketball there, but we made it only to a few tryouts and then decided we'd better concentrate on our studies and the beach. It turned out that Hawaii was a little too perfect. Perpetual sunshine isn't necessarily conducive to serious academics for 18-year-old Alaska girls. Besides, we were homesick for mountains, cooler seasons, and even snow. After that first semester, we realized that we'd better transfer back to something closer to our reality so we could actually earn our degrees. Tilly and I opted for a more conventional and affordable campus, choosing Idaho because it was much like Alaska, yet still outside, which is Alaskan's alternative term for the lower 48. I still desperately wanted to earn a journalism degree and to put my passion for sports and writing to work as a sports reporter. After our freshman year, Tilly and I returned to Wasilla for summer work at a little diner. While we were home, our friend Linda Menard talked me into entering the local Miss America scholarship pageant with the promise of tuition for college. I thought it was a horrendous idea at first. I was a jock and quite square, not a pageant-type girl at all. I didn't wear makeup in high school and kept my hair short because I didn't like wasting time primping. I couldn't relate to the way I assume most cheerleader types thought and lived, and figured it was those girls who were equipped for the pageant thing. On the other hand, there was the scholarship money. I knew I wasn't a good enough athlete to get a Division I scholarship, but I did want to graduate debt-free. Was there some way I could make this work? I thought about it for a couple of days. My stomach knotted up at the thought of parading around on stage in a swimsuit, especially since I'd packed on the famous freshman 15 and wasn't in the best shape of my life. It would be humbling at best, risky and embarrassing at worst. But a scholarship was a scholarship, and in the end, pragmatism won out. Half seriously, I wondered if the pageant organization would accept for the talent portion of the competition a fancy display of right and left-hand dribbling. But Linda suggested I play the flute, something I'd been doing since age 10. Linda also reminded me that the scholarship money was generous, especially if I won individual competitions within the pageant, in addition to the Miss Wasilla crown. I enlisted the advice of former pageant winner, my friend Diane Minnick. Then I shocked my friends and family, put on a sequined warrior red gown, danced the opening numbers, gave the interview, and uncomfortably let my butt be compared to the cheerleaders' butts. I played my flute, and I won. In fact, I won every segment of the competition, even Miss Congeniality. The Miss Wasilla scholarship paid my college tuition that fall. The following summer, I progressed to the next round and was crowned second runner-up and Miss Congeniality in the Miss Alaska Scholarship Pageant. I had to admit it was good tuition money, as well as good testing ground for public speaking and issue advocacy, and I was happy to be even more involved in the community via this non-traditional adventure that took me out of my comfort zone. I went on to pay for 2 more years of college the same way. Idaho's down-home feeling and gorgeous campus on the rolling hills of the Palouse helped lessen the homesickness I felt for Alaska. Childhood friends from the Carter and Kearney families attended the University of Idaho with me, and even Chuck and Molly were fellow Vandals. They pledged Greek, so I enjoyed extended Sigma Alpha Epsilon and Alpha Phi families through them. But I, ever the independent, was proudly GDI. I was amazed when my education became an issue in the vice presidential campaign. Well, look at that, the pundit said. She went to all those different schools, and it took her 5 years to graduate. Yes, it did take me 5 years, because I paid my own way. Tilly and I came home to Alaska between semesters and worked so we could earn money to pay for the next term. Sometimes we had to take a semester off and work until we could afford tuition again. I remember when that was an honorable thing. At UI, I lived in an all-girls dorm. I planned on a political science minor because I loved studying U.S. history and government and knew poli-sci would mesh well with a journalism major. Although my family wasn't political, certainly not obsessively partisan, I registered to vote in 1982 at age 18 and proudly checked the Republican box on the registration form. I had read both major party platforms, and the GOP just made sense for someone like me. A believer in individual rights and responsibilities rather than heavy-handed government, in free market principles that included reward for hard work, respect for equality, support for a strong military, and a belief that America is the best country on earth. I looked forward to every poli-sci lecture. I attributed my enthusiasm to patriotism and a fascination with current events. I was also eager because this was the 1980s, and our studies centered around one of the most inspiring individuals ever to occupy the White House, President Ronald W. Reagan. I was in high school the day Reagan took the oath of office. On the same day, minutes after he was sworn in, a band of Iranian militants released 52 Americans after having held them and our national pride hostage for 444 days. I had followed the Iran hostage crisis and remembered wondering why President Jimmy Carter didn't act more decisively. From my high schooler's perspective, I thought the question was, why did he allow America to be humiliated and pushed around? The new president being sworn in radiated confidence and optimism. The enemies of freedom took notice. In years to come, people would ask, what did he have that Carter didn't? To me, the answer was obvious. He had a steel spine. I appreciated Reagan's passion and conviction and the way he so plainly articulated his love for our country. Like millions of others, I related to him personally. He was one of us. I liked him, and I liked the fact that he was never afraid to call it as he saw it. During the previous decade, we seemed to have slid into a darker period as a country. Vietnam, Watergate, the energy crisis, the perception of environmental abuses, the Iran humiliation, made worse by the abortive hostage rescue attempt. Reagan's optimism restored our faith in ourselves. Yes, maybe our nation had veered off course, he seemed to be saying, but not only could we right ourselves, America's best days were still ahead. As Reagan's presidency unfolded, I also appreciated his focus on a handful of overarching themes, such as reining in the intrusiveness of government, building a strong national defense, and cutting taxes. I knew the previous administration had left a legacy of soaring unemployment, sky-high taxes, and rampant inflation. Reagan's plan for growing our economy made sense: reduce reliance on government by cutting taxes and putting more money into the hands of the people who earned it. At the peak of Soviet military power, Democrats had retreated into an embarrassed pacifism, cutting defense projects and reducing our troop strength. But the new Republican president I was studying in school unabashedly set out to make the United States the strongest power in the world. Reagan's plan for national defense was logical, to build up our military while pursuing diplomacy with the Soviet Union. Critics derided him as a warmonger. But as a violent 20th century came to an end, Reagan's position ultimately led to a climactic victory for freedom and peace with the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the liberation of millions from the tyranny of communism. Reagan won the Cold War without firing a shot. "America is still the abiding alternative to tyranny," Reagan said. "That is our purpose in the world, nothing more and nothing less." Ideas and speeches like that inspired me. I had always subscribed to concepts like providence and purpose, that people aren't just random collections of molecules stumbling aimlessly through history. I believed, and still do, that each person has a destiny, a reason for being. So Reagan's sense of national purpose resonated with me. His speeches on the subject evoked in me the sense of national pride I had felt even back at Eagle River Elementary School when I watched our astronauts explore the final frontier. As Reagan said, America was more than a place in the world. It was a world-changing idea, founded on a set of principles that had weathered many storms. Reagan restored our faith that those principles would prove themselves again. During semesters in college and summers back in Alaska, I interned at a couple of TV sports desks. I covered high school and college sports, putting together packages and writing sports copy for many anchors, including the two guys who gave me a chance, John Hernandez and John Carpenter. On weekends during one season, I anchored the sports desk live. I loved the intensity of the newsroom, the deadlines, the adrenaline. Unmarried and with no kids, I spent hours and hours at the station. I felt I was on my way. I also began paying more and more attention to the chatter from the news desk, especially at Anchorage's NBC affiliate, KTUU. It was always politics first and everything except natural disasters second. In Alaska, we don't have big league professional sports teams or many celebrities, except famous dog mushers. So for many up here, politics is just another sport. So even as I covered sports, my interest in public policy and how it affected people continued to grow. In Alaska, much of our local news involves natural resource issues, balancing human needs with environmental ones. The Alaska Constitution charges state government with managing natural resources for abundance, for equal access to plentiful supplies, and that takes conscientious stewardship. For many in Alaska, being green isn't about wearing Birkenstocks and driving a hybrid. It's about survival. Throughout this time, Todd and I continued to see each other, though miles apart during college. We wrote letters, made phone calls, and saw each other during vacations. But it was challenging trying to stay together while so far apart. It was a huge relief when I graduated, grabbed my diploma, and beat feet back to Alaska, happy to be in the same state as Todd. In the summer of 1988, I fished again with Todd, but this time during slow runs, I waited tables at the rowdy Bristol Inn, where drunken fishing crews doled out more in tips than I earned on the water all season. Still, money was tight because we had to reinvest our earnings in new nets and boat motors that season. By the end of summer, Todd and I didn't want to spend any more time apart, so we took our broke butts down to the Palmer Courthouse and lassoed a magistrate to pronounce us man and wife. Our witnesses would come from where they often do at this courthouse, across the street at the old folks' home. I walked over to the Palmer Pioneer's home to see who was available. Todd followed me in the car, saying, "See if you could find a couple of people who could make it to the car without wheelchairs." I couldn't find any who fit the bill, but I found a nice elderly man with a walker and a kindly old lady in a wheelchair who agreed to see us into matrimony. They couldn't squeeze into Todd's little Honda coupe, so we had no choice but to escort them across the street, where, on August 29, 1988, those nice Alaska pioneers witnessed the beginning of two lives joined together at the Palmer Courthouse. The magistrate, Mrs. Fife, was young and brand new to the position, and she cried as she read the boilerplate vows. Then we walked our witnesses back across the street and stopped by the Wendy's drive-thru for our wedding dinner. Very much in love and oblivious to the idea that we needed to do anything conventional for anyone else's sake, we left bouquets of flowers on our parents' front porches with notes announcing that we'd eloped. I heard later that Mom bawled. I'd do the same. I tell my kids now that I'll wring their necks if they do what I did. I want my kids to have the wedding I didn't have. Todd moved into the apartment that my sister Heather and I shared in Anchorage, and the three of us undertook a whirlwind work schedule that turned our tiny apartment into a revolving door. Todd worked as a baggage handler for an Alaska Airlines subsidiary during the day and worked at night plowing snow and clearing the steps of the BP Exploration Alaska office building until the fishing season would start again. I worked customer service at an Anchorage electric utility during the day and reported for a local station part-time in the evenings and on weekends. Heather put her college degree to work, working with audiologists in special needs children's classrooms. Todd applied for a full-time job with BP, working in the North Slope oil fields. We hoped he'd land the kind of slope job so many young Alaskans dream of, so he could work a schedule that would allow him to enjoy as many of our outdoor passions as possible while making a good living. While he waited, he worked. I remember him working so hard that he dropped to about 150 pounds from handling the bags in the belly of the plane. Surely it couldn't have been my newlywed cooking skills that contributed to that. While he slimmed down, I porked up, pregnant with our first child. As the months went on, Todd's prayer was answered by an offer for a permanent position with BP. He'd moved up from plowing parking lots to working a week-on, week-off schedule in the rich oil patch that BP partially controlled in Prudhoe Bay near the top of the continent, earning a king's ransom of $14 an hour. On April 20th, 1989, my life truly began. I became a mom. I had no idea how this tiny person, my son, would turn me inside out and upside down with the all-consuming love that swelled my heart from the second he was born. As cliched as it sounds, that was the happiest day of my life. My nature-loving dad became a grandpa for the first time that spring day. He said he'd never forget the day because it's when the geese returned north to migrate. He liked that we'd named our son Track C.J. Palin. But he mistakenly assumed track signified adventure. Track, right? He said. Like tracking an elephant? I explained that no, it was because obviously we love sports, and the baby was born during the spring track season. What if he'd been born during wrestling season, Dad asked. Would you have named him Wrestle? No, I said, smiling. We'd have named him Matt. And if he'd been born during basketball? Well, we could have named him Court. And hockey? What's wrong with Zamboni? Just before Track was born, Todd and I moved to a small apartment in Wasilla. Todd and I shared one car, and we loved our little life together. Though with the slope and fishing schedule, we still didn't see each other very much. I was surprised by how much I loved motherhood. We desperately wanted another baby right away, so I was excited when I learned I was pregnant again. We were sure it was another boy, and we decided to call him Tad, a combination of Todd and Track. I love the fact that we had planned so well and that events were falling neatly into place in our well-ordered lives. Our babies would be a year apart, right on schedule. At the beginning of my second trimester, I went in for my monthly exam. Todd was on the slope. He'd always been good about leaving me short love notes before he left. But as I drove to the doctor's office, his latest replayed in my head because it had a special addendum. I love you, Tad. At my exam, the doctor listened for the baby's heartbeat. When she didn't smile, I didn't worry. She was known for her mellow demeanor. But I noticed that she kept moving the stethoscope around, and she didn't hand it to me as other doctors usually do, so the expectant mother can listen to the sound of life. Let's do a quick sonogram, she said. I agreed, eager to confirm that Tad was a boy, or to be surprised. We moved to another room, and I lay down on a sheet-covered table. The doctor spread gel on my belly and began sliding the transducer back and forth, and I waited expectantly for the familiar shush-shush-shush sound of the baby's beating heart, but it didn't come, and the sonogram picture looked empty. The doctor said coldly, "There's nothing alive in there." Her bluntness shocked me. I felt sick and hollow and burst into tears. "You have a couple of choices about getting rid of it," she said. It, that's what she called our baby, whom we'd been calling Tad for 3 months. She went on to explain that I could go home and let it pass naturally, or I could have a D&C. I wasn't listening. I was praying. Why, God, why? I was stunned and felt so very empty. It was my first taste of close personal tragedy, the kind that rocks a relatively untested faith. I dressed and walked numbly through the waiting room and out to the parking lot and drove myself home. Mom came over to watch track, a friend stopped by, but I just lay on my bed feeling like the world had stopped spinning. As my mom had warned me years before, everyone goes through trials. Our friend Mary Ellen called to echo the same thoughts and to pray for me. A miscarriage is often dismissed as something a woman needs to shake off quickly, but it's impossible to explain the devastation and loss unless you've experienced it. Todd flew home to be with me when I had the DNC. When the doctor's bill arrived in our mailbox, it came with a typo. In the box describing the procedure, someone had typed abortion. Instead of starting over with a fresh form, they painted it over with a thin layer of whiteout and retyped miscarriage. For some reason, it just felt like salt in the wound. I had lost three of my grandparents and a very good friend by then, but my heart ached more for this baby than for anything else. The miscarriage carved a new depth in my heart. I became a little less Pollyanna-ish, a little less naive about being invincible and in control, and I became a lot more attuned to other people's pain. I'd left the TV sports desk when track and Bristol were babies, pouring my energy into my kids. Like most moms, I also sought an outlet to prevent stir craziness, and I still craved getting out to sweat. I found both on an exercise floor with a group of future best friends. Our kids would grow up together, and the group of us gals would support each other through tragedy and triumph, divorces and deaths, new births and birthdays, and politics. I love my girlfriends, the Elite Six, as one of them facetiously dubbed us because we're the antithesis of elite. A diverse group of two Democrats, two Republicans, one independent, and one who still won't tell us what she is. Our friendship has spanned two decades now. We can talk about everything, and we don't scream at each other about anything, especially not politics. I also kept my hand in journalism, working a couple of days a week at the Frontiersman as a proofreader and submitting a sports column every once in a while. So I didn't suffer too much guilt over leaving the kids for a few hours.